You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 91, our 10th Q&A. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Very good. Very good. Been on the road and glad to be back.
I wanted to call attention. I was kind of looking at the stats on the shows and stuff, and I noticed that episode 86, which was about the head covering in 1 Corinthians, and I want to promote that show a little bit and plug it and see if we can get a little bit more listeners, maybe some people who don't listen to every episode of the show. But to me, I think this is the quintessential episode that points to what we're trying to do here and what the show is about. And 86, I think, really is a shining example of the content that you're producing.
Yeah, you just want more people at Unseen Realm events to bring that up during Q&A.
True.
I mean, every place I've gone since we did that episode, somebody has asked something about the head covering or come up to me and said, oh, I can't believe that one episode about the head covering. You had to send my kids out of the room. You know,
just... I know. It's good. I mean, it's really a good episode. It's one of my favorite ones. So if you have not listened to that show, please go back and listen to it. It's one of my favorites. All right, well, let's get into our 10th Q&A here. We've got probably 10 or so questions, so I'm ready if you're ready.
Sure, let's go.
Okay, our first one is from Isaac. In Mark 8:33, when Jesus tells Peter to, quote, get behind me, Satan, end quote, he is obviously using the term in the Old Testament sense of an oppositional role that can apply to humans and not to Peter, having been possessed by a singular cosmic arch nemesis. This seems to be reflected in some translations, such as those by N.T. Wright, wherein he prefers to use the Satan in his translation as opposed to Satan, capital S there. During New Testament exegesis, to what extent should we consider the authors to have intended the use of role as opposed to singular cosmic arch nemesis? Furthermore, should there be a clear delineation between Satan and Diabolos, or is it much more murky given they appear conflated in the Septuagint?
Yeah, I think I'd say, first of all, I do agree, you know, with the adversarial sense behind what Jesus is saying here to Peter. I don't think there's any contextual argument for presuming that Peter was Satan, you know, that he was like turned into or viewed as, you know, Satan, the cosmic, you know, nemesis. I also don't see any contextual argument that he was possessed. I mean, where you get that elsewhere, the language is pretty clear about Satan entering into, you know, someone like Judas or something like that. So I don't think that's intended at all. And I do think what is intended is, again, the term being used essentially saying, you know, hey, Peter, don't oppose me. Don't be an adversary, you know, to what I've just said and what's coming down the road. So I think Wright and others, of course, it's not, you know, something that only he has noticed, but I think that's the consistent way to view it. You know, the whole question about distinguishing between Satan and Diabolos, I mean, the equation is certainly made in the New Testament, but it's all about context, you know. So if you have a situation where one or the other term is used, especially if it's, you know, Satan, then I think you have to look at context. Is this a neutral use of the term, or does it refer to an entity? And I mean, I've actually looked this up, and you can't really determine it through morphology alone or the use of the definite article, because in Greek anyway, you know, Greek is not Hebrew, so the stuff about the definite article that I have in the book about an Unseen Realm about Satan with the article doesn't really apply here because it's a different language. But you will have instances where Satanas, okay, Greek, there occurs with or without the article, where the context clearly points to a specific individual, again, the devil or some other term that's applied to him. So it's not, there's no neat breakdown there. And Diabolos, the devil, is certainly used of Satan in the New Testament. But does that mean everywhere that we see one term, Satan, that we need to think of the other? Well, you know, not necessarily. And I think Mark 8:33 is a good instance of that. And that overlap in terms, you know, does start in the Septuagint. But again, it you can't just say, you can't look at a trend or a phenomenon and say, well, I see this trend or phenomenon here, so everywhere, you know, I run into the same term, I have to think this way. Again, that isn't the case. You know, trends are trends, phenomena are phenomena, with, you know, even with outliers, you know, to deal with, and you certainly have outliers here. So context is always king. You try to determine what is the best sense, the best semantic sense of the term in any given context, and you can't impose a meaning that would work in one context with all the other contexts.
Okay, our next two questions are from Corby. First question is, Mike has talked about how Psalm 82 speaks of the punishment of the Elohim for failing in a Yahweh-assigned task. He has suggested that the Elohim fail to faithfully testify about Yahweh to the nations. Is it overreaching to see in Acts 14 a polemic against the failure of both the Elohim and the Jews to testify faithfully about Yahweh to the nations? If so, what does this say about Paul and the apostolic mission from a Deuteronomy 32 perspective as faithful emissaries of Yahweh over and against the Elohim and Jews who failed to point the nations to Yahweh?
Yeah, I would quibble with the terminology of the question a little bit. I mean, I don't think that it was the job of the sons of God, you know, the Elohim in Psalm 82, who are being judged, who were put over the nations, assigned to the nations in Deuteronomy 32. I don't think it was their job to testify about Yahweh. That language is a bit too strong. And Corby didn't use that terminology, but I kind of got the flavor or the feeling from the question that he thought I was suggesting that they were supposed to like evangelize or something like that, bring the nations, you know, actively to, you know, back to faith in Yahweh. I think that goes a little bit too far. What I have said is that it was their job to rule the nations justly according to Yahweh's law, and of course not solicit worship that belonged to Yahweh to themselves. They violated both of those situations. The former Psalm 82 makes clear, and the latter about the worship issue, Deuteronomy makes clear. But again, that isn't sort of like active evangelism. So I don't know if that's what the, you know, Corby was thinking of in the question or not, but I kind of got that feeling from it. So I think we should say that. I mean, Paul thinks in some way, and he's not specific, but Paul apparently thinks that in some way, the situation, you know, where the nations were assigned to the other gods and, you know, dispersed, that would prompt people in those nations to seek God. Acts 17, 26 and 27. Let me just read that. You know, Paul says, he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way toward him and find him. Again, Paul sees some relationship between the return of the nations, you know, sort of into the fold, back into the family of Yahweh, and this situation that derives from what happened at Babel. But again, even his statement doesn't actually have them doing some sort of evangelism or have them testifying to the nations about the true God. So I think that's, you know, goes a little bit too far. So, you know, the rest of the question about referring to Acts 14, you know, something about Acts 14 being a polemic against the failure of the Elohim. Of course, Acts 14 is when the Gentiles mistakenly identify Paul and his, you know, his preaching companion. I can't remember exactly who it was. Was it Paul and Silas in Acts 14? It identifies them as gods, divine beings, Zeus and Hermes, and that sort of thing. And of course, Paul says, "No, wait a minute. You know, we're just men like you. We're not gods." So is Acts 14 kind of a polemic? Because here you have two men that people assume are gods testifying to the people about the Messiah. You know, is this some sort of, is there something going on there that would go back to Psalm 82 and say, hey, look, you know, two guys out here are doing your job, you know, doing the job that you gods should have done, and you gods are inept and whatever, and you deserve judgment back in Psalm 82. I think that's a stretch. I think it goes a bit too far. So I would view it as overreaching. I mean, Paul denies the identification, which sort of seems necessary for the analogy, but of course he wouldn't have to affirm it. But I again, literarily, it's a stronger case if there's something, you know, a little more pointed in that direction. I guess what I would say is I need to see more in the text? In other words, is there some definite hook linguistically, textually, you know, some term that really matters? Is there a hook back into Psalm 82 in Acts 14? And I don't know of any. So for that reason, plus just more generally, that I don't see, again, evangelism or telling the nations, giving the nations a message about Yahweh. I don't see that as a specific thing that's brought up in Psalm 82. So for those two reasons, I would be disinclined, again, to go that direction with Acts 14.
Okay. Corby's second question is, just heard Larry Hurtado discussing Jesus' devotion. He speculated that if Paul was asked why Jesus was worshipped, Paul's answer would be something like, quote, God raised him, God exalted him, and God requires that we worship him, end quote. In contrast, Hurtado said that Greek notions of essence and person would not have been categories that Paul would have used to describe or understand Jesus' relationship to Yahweh. My question is, how would Second Temple Jewish views of divine plurality, angel of the Lord, divine counsel, co-regent stuff, give us more insight into how Paul would have understood Jesus in light of the Shema and exclusive worship of Yahweh? Though Hurtado said Greek thought didn't provide the categories for the earliest Jewish Christians to understand this Yahweh-Jesus relationship, he didn't seem to make an attempt to unpack categories available to first century Jewish Christians that could illuminate the situation, such as Old Testament divine plurality concepts and language. This left me very confused. And he sent the question to Dr. Hurtado, and his response was, quote, I contend that the chief agent traditions were a factor, but not sufficient to account for the kind of cultic reverence given to Jesus. None of them receives anything equivalent, end quote. Does Mike agree with Hurtado's assessment? I get the impression from Dr. Heiser that Jewish divine plurality ideas were far more influential in New Testament thought than guys like Hurtado are granting.
Yeah, I mean, I've mentioned before that, you know, Larry Hurtado, I mean, we know each other and we've chatted a good bit about this. We disagree on this point, and I'm not the only one who disagrees with Hurtado on this point. What it really comes down to, questions like, you know, his contention, you know, that chief agent traditions were a factor but not sufficient to account, you know, for the cultic reverence, you know, that's a key phrase for him, given to Jesus. Well, it depends how you look at worship. Cultic reverence, you know, that tells you sort of where Hurtado's at on worship. He's defining worship in terms of cult ritual, cult observance. And for those who don't know, the word cult there refers to, again, kind of ritual observances, something where you, you know, there's prayer, you know, prayer to a certain being, in this case, Jesus, in what we're talking about here. There's some sort of, you know, ritual observance that has him as the focus. Okay, there's the Lord's Supper, you know, that sort of thing. So his argument is that, well, the other chief agents that you see in Second Temple Judaism never get that kind of stuff. People don't pray to them. There is no, you know, ritual service element that would show that they are the object of devotion like you do with Yahweh of Israel. And so, you know, that's why his answer goes in the direction it goes. Well, there are a lot of people who think that Hurtado defines worship too narrowly. And I would also, I mean, I would be one of those, but I would also ask, you know, how do you divorce incarnation, you know, from all of this? So it, sure. Yeah. The other chief agents don't get, you know, the sort of, you know, adoration or devotion again that Jesus does. Well, they're also not incarnate. Okay. They're not the incarnation. In other words, that element is lacking in the way other chief agents get talked about in Second Temple Jewish literature. It's not lacking in the New Testament. And so once you factor the incarnation in, then this person, Jesus, becomes, again, in flesh, the God of Israel. And so what Hurtado is saying is that knowledge alone, in his view, is somehow insufficient, would not have prompted worship. And that seems a little odd to me. So why would I feel, as a Jew, why would I feel compelled to worship the God of Israel just for who he is in the Old Testament? And then if I believe that same God is now in this man, is incarnate in this man, Jesus, so, you know, why wouldn't I just sort of automatically look at him the same way. You know, Hurtado's, you know, again, trying to sort of not go that direction. And I think his view is too narrow. And so I don't think that he's really considering Jesus' identity consistently in terms of the way he approaches it. I want to, let me just flip real quickly. I have a number of, there are a number of people that sort of criticize Hurtado on this point, and not in a caustic way. When I say criticize, I mean, they just, you know, they don't buy it. So in a lot of the Two Powers stuff, this name will be familiar. I can get it open here. Daniel Boyer, in his article, The Gospel of the Memra, and it's about Jewish binitarianism and the prologue to John, you know, the beginning of the Gospel of John there, that's very familiar to most Christians. On page 257, there's a long footnote, and Boyer writes this. I'm going to read this just to give you a flavor of how other scholars look at Hurtado's sort of narrow definition of things here. And again, Boyerin is a Jew, but he's really into the Two Powers, you know, whole discussion. So he would say, while in general I find Hurtado's argument bracing and important, his exclusive reliance on only one criterion, worship, as determining the divine nature of a given intermediary seems to me overly narrow and rigid. There may be no gainsaying his demonstration, I think, that worship of the incarnate Logos is a novum, it's something new, a mutation, as he styles it, introduced by Jesus' people. But the belief in an intermediary, a deuteros theos, a second God, was common to them and other Jews. To Hurtado's one-dimensional notion of what constitutes a divine being, contrast Daniel Abrams. Quote, now he's going to, Boyerin is going to quote Daniel Abrams here. So the quote begins, when is an attribute a literary means of describing divine activity, and when is it personified as a hypostatic element, receiving an identity of its own, while nevertheless partaking in the divine ontology? The latter appears to be the case when the physical manifestation of God is not excluded from the divine being. The on this criterion, as I have indicated, this is Boyerin now, the quote's over. On this criterion, as I have indicated, many non-Christian Jews did indeed believe in second divinities or second divine beings. So, you know, I'm still not really sure why, you know, Hurtado wants to see the worship of Jesus, wants to see the binitarian thing that you see in the New Testament. Why he wants to look at that, what happens with Jesus, as being totally unique. In other words, there's this hesitancy to tie it back into other chief agent figures and you know, second deity figures, second divinity figures, and all that stuff. And again, on one level, the answer to my own question there is, well, he doesn't want to tie it back to them because if you look at those other examples, they don't receive worship, and so he sees this disconnection. And okay, that's true, but does that really build a wall between what's going on in the New Testament and what's happening in these other examples? Because they do use phrases like deuteros theos, you know, the second God. They do depict second agents on Yahweh's throne, which again is language that you see in the New Testament of Jesus. I mean, these things are in the text. And so to sort of focus on cultic reverence, to use Hurtado's term, to me just seems a little bit narrow. And I'm not sure really here's the uncertainty with me. I'm not sure really what purpose this serves. I mean, why does it matter? And again, I've talked to Larry enough to know that it does, but I'm still not sure why, you know, why it matters. Why, you know, does he want to reserve something, some special, extra special category for Jesus? I'm not sure. But again, it seems to me that the way we look at Jesus, and again, factoring in the incarnation, when you look back again at the Old Testament, you do have Yahweh as a man along with an invisible Yahweh. You do get that. And so if I'm a Jew that's sort of aware that this sort of thing happens in the text, you know, I'm going to connect it, you know, back to the Old Testament. And when you have other texts, other Jewish texts that sort of riff off or build off some of these passages, And they might not express it exactly the same way as the New Testament does, or to the nth degree that the New Testament does. Well, okay. They don't all have to be the same, but yet there's, I still look at it as, again, more of a consistent, there's more consistency here than inconsistency, I think, even though, again, the worship thing is important, and that is a disconnect. Again, I'm not denying that, but I just don't think that is sufficient reason to sort of disconnect, you know, what's happening back here. I just don't know what point it really serves, but, you know, maybe someday I'll have another conversation with Larry and he'll say something that makes it go off in my head. I don't know. I just, but to this point, I'm not sure why it matters so much to talk about it one way as opposed to another.
Our next question's from Bill. I don't believe Babel was an historic event. Human languages show a definite lineage and it doesn't match the Babel story. Does that matter? Doesn't the interpretation still work since the first century Jews believed it to be historical? In a general sense, how much historicity is required of Genesis 1 through 11 for the divine counsel interpretation to work?
Well, I would say in very loose general terms, if you're looking at divine counsel stuff as a theological statement, both in terms of a supernatural realm and in terms of how, you know, how people not only believed that the divine world intersected with the human world, but also that it did in some way, then you don't need precise historicity. But I'm actually going to object to the premise of the question, because I think evangelicals tend to overclaim when it comes to Genesis 11 and the whole Babel language thing. I think they overread the passage, and that feels like what's the cause or what's behind this question. In other words, because because you can't really do linguistics, let's just put it this way, you can't really be, you know, there's no linguist that's going to say that all the languages of the world come from one language, okay? And that's, there's just no evidence for that, okay? That's true. But here's my question. Does the Tower of Babel story require that thought? I don't think it does. That's why I'm saying evangelicals tend to overreach and overclaim from this passage. Let's just go look at the passage here. We have Genesis 11. Here's what we read. Come, you know, God is the speaker here, again, speaking to, you know, his counsel. Come, let us go down and there confuse their language. Again, we in verse 1, it makes the text makes the statement that all the world had one language, okay? Come, let us go down and there confuse their language so that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord dispersed them from there over the face of all the earth, and they left off building the city. Therefore, its name was called Babel, because the Lord confused the language of all the earth. Now, this has been read so frequently to say that, oh, there was one language, and now all the languages of the world resulted from this event. That is not actually what the text says. So here are my questions. Where is the claim in those verses? Where is the claim in the text that all the earth's languages arose as a result of what happened here? There is no such claim in the text. The text says the language of the people in verse 1 was one, they had one language, and that circumstance, having one language, that was ruined. That was undone. So in verse 1, we have the whole earth had one language, and then in verse 9, the Lord confused that one language of all the earth. We're not told how many languages, you know, created the confusion. We're not given a number at all. Was it two? Was it four? You know, why does it have to be, you know, 10, 20,000, you know, with all the dialects that we see today? Again, that is assumed, that is read into Genesis 11, and it's linguistically indefensible, just on the basis of linguistic science. You know, and even if you say, well, look, you know, we're talking about the nations that they knew about. There's 70 of them, Genesis 10 and all that kind of stuff. Even if you take those, it doesn't work. Because if you actually go look at, you know, ancient languages, there you have, again, without getting too peripheral here, too, you know, far off the beaten path, Sumerian as a language is unaffiliated. It's not Semitic. It's not Asian, okay? It's not Egyptian. It stands alone, okay? What it is something that you can't tie all the others to, and frankly, it's difficult to tie any known language completely to Sumerian. There are some candidates, that have some specific overlaps with Sumerian, but nothing sort of works that says, oh, we understand that Sumerian was the parent language of this, that, or the other thing. Okay, even Akkadian. Akkadian is a Semitic language. Sumerian is not. Akkadians used the Sumerian script, the invention of cuneiform, to represent their own language. So their relationship is the script, the idea, the innovation of using wedges to represent verbal speech. It's not that the languages are related, because they're not. Egyptian, again, sort of is by itself, because it has traces of the Hamitic family, the African family, and also some Semitic. But neither of those is related to Sumerian. So there's a complete disconnect there. Again, I'll just stop there. But you know, you have a situation, even if you're talking about the 70 nations of Genesis 10, where this doesn't work linguistically with all of the data at our disposal. But I would suggest to you, Genesis 11 never claims that. It never says that all – think about what it says. All the earth had one language, and that gets confused. That's a lot different than saying all the earth had one language, and at the end of the Babel event, the earth had 70 languages, okay, or 20 or 30 or whatever. It never says that. That has to be read into the account. So while I would say, you know, again, just broadly, loosely, you don't have to have, you know, some sort of detailed proofiness for every, you know, for the historicity of every item in Genesis 1 to 11 to buy into the divine council worldview. You don't have to have that at all. You have to believe that, again, there is a supernatural world and it intersects with our world. And again, you have to believe in big concepts like, you know, Yahweh chose a people for himself. The other ones he doesn't. He disinherits, still interested in them, that kind of thing. And those are big picture, broad, you know, sweeping theological concepts. So you can embrace all that without saying, well, or was it or in southern Mesopotamia or northwestern Mesopotamia, since I can't know for sure. I just have to throw up my hands and say I can't believe any of it. I mean, that's just ridiculous. Again, you don't need that. But I will, again, object to just the premise of the question, because I do think evangelicals typically overread the whole incident.
Mike, Bill's going to get a gold star for his word of the show, historicity. Historicity. That he gets my gold
say that,
star.
Say that fast 10 times.
Historicity, 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 historicity. That's the gold star of the show. That's probably going to be a new thing, Mike. Who gets the Trey's gold star word of the show?
Kind of like the Groucho Marx, the secret word. Or, you know. Yeah, I'm dating myself there. But.
All right. Well, the next one's kind of fun, and it's from Renee. And his question is, I've heard Mike in a few interviews hint at a few interesting stories regarding his early Christian walk at home with his parents. Mike, could you tell us a few of those situations? I think testimonies like that are insightful and fun. And then he also has the information presented in the Facade novel surprised or changed your parents' belief on the reality of the UFO phenomenon.
Well, I'll take the second one first. I don't know. They've never really commented on the UFO thing, so I don't know one way or the other, you know, what they think about that. They constantly kind of needle me for killing them off in the first book. It's like, what did we do? You know, you killed us off in the first book, and now, you know, what? It's like, well, just kind of get over it. It's a novel, you know, Mom. Just don't worry about it. No, they have a good time with it. I will also say that in The Portent, boy, you know, for those who haven't read The Portent, how do I talk about this without giving a spoiler away? In The Portent, there is a scene and a conversation where two people are talking about how they met a third character, and it was through a supernatural visitation where someone who was dead visited somebody else and gave them a very brief instruction that was a portent, that was a foreshadowing of a set of circumstances that play out in real life and bring these characters together. Well, that episode does come from something my parents did experience. And I can tell you my parents' experience because it doesn't completely overlap to the item in the story. This is, boy, I don't know how many years ago now, it's maybe 20. My dad's dad had died, and they didn't have, you know, they didn't have the best of relationship, but toward, you know, the latter part of his dad's life, it was considerably mended and positive. But I think, you know, part of my dad's concern at the time, because they were believers by this time in their own lives, was about, you know, hey, my dad, you know, what's going on here? Because his dad had been a churchgoer, you know, all of his life, but really, I think it's probably fair to say just churchgoer. There's, you know, without, you know, a lot of what you would associate with being a true Christian or a real Christian, you know, just leave it at that. So I don't know necessarily how my dad thought about that, but I think there was some concern. And so after the funeral, I went to the funeral. I had to go back, you know, home, and they went to their place. Well, I don't know if it was a few days or a week or whatever later, I get this phone call, and my dad says, we have to tell you something that happened. And again, they're telling me because I'm the Bible guy, I'm supposed to know what's going on here. So they said, we went to bed, and they had in their room a clock, and it was one of these clocks that would talk. I don't know if any people in the audience remember these, but you used to get these novelty clocks, and they'd say little things like, get out of bed, get up at 7 o'clock, you know, whatever. So they were programmed to say something, you know, when the alarm went off, instead of, you know, a clanging sound or whatever, instead of beeping, they would say something that they were programmed to say. Well, they had this clock in their room. They went to bed, and they were laying there, and my dad said, all of a sudden, just out of the blue, the clock spoke to them. The clock said, everything's okay, 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 okay. And that was something his dad used to say all the time. It was sort of his thing, you know, his little ditty that he would say. And my dad said, I just looked over at your mother and asked, did you hear that? Because he wanted to, you know, make sure that I wasn't imagining this. And my mom said, oh, yeah, you know, I heard it. So they got up, they disconnected the clock and put it in the closet. You know, that was the end of the use of the clock. But they wanted to tell me this and, you know, ask what I thought and so on and so forth. So I used that episode in the book. So there's at least that much of a connection. So if the question, you know, was about, you know, stuff like that, well, they're going to be right there, because that actually happened to them. Again, they're my parents. They have no reason to lie to me. It just, there it was. It is what it is. Now back to the first part, you know, anecdotes. Boy, I became a Christian when I was in high school, and I wasn't raised in any sort of Christian tradition. You know, my mom tells me they had me baptized. I'll take her word for it, because obviously I don't remember any of it. You know, we never went to church. We never did anything like that. It was very irreligious in that respect. My dad, who I refer to as my dad, he's actually my stepdad. He and my mom were married when we were real little. I was 5, my brother was 3. But they, again, he had all sorts of experiences, you know, in Vietnam and Korea, and a very, very hardened, you know, person. Again, I don't think he would say he didn't believe in God, but he didn't really have a very high view of God. I think that would be fair. So it wasn't anything that really mattered, you know, to the family, you know, religion, quote unquote. But I became a Christian when I was in high school, through the influence of a friend who is the namesake for Brian Scott in The Facade, and of course The Portent. That was this guy's name, my friend. We met when we were 9 years old, and you know, eventually in high school I became a Christian. Well, it wasn't the best situation. Because my parents thought I had joined a cult, because I was going to church not once a Sunday, but twice. And I even went during the midweek. Okay. So that this was just bizarre behavior to them. You know, going to youth activities. Well, that's nice. You have something to do, that you're not in trouble, but it's all this church stuff. So they admitted to me years later that they used to do things to me and say things just to see what I would do, because they had no frame of reference for this. So when I was a senior in high school, at school we had a class called The Bible as Literature. So there's all these kids taking their Bible to school. I was forbidden from taking my Bible to school. So here I am, you know, I'm like, you know, a real Christian, but everybody else is taking it because they have this class, but I'm not allowed to. It was just ridiculous, but that's what they wanted. So, you know, you obey your parents. I walked into arguments that my parents had about whether Mike was gay because I didn't go out and I didn't go out and, you know, have sex with girls in my car like my brother did. Not my natural brother, but a stepbrother was really a carouser. But it was like, that was normal, but Mike is abnormal. So it's like, I walked into this conversation, like, I can't really believe that I'm hearing this, but the context, you know, for it made sense. My mom went off on me one time and I don't know what she was mad at me for. Again, it was something spiritual. I mean, you don't even have to, be confronted, because when you're a good testimony, it's going to really create tension with people who are, you know, being challenged, you know, by the Holy Spirit about their own spiritual condition. So she got mad at me for something one time, and she just yelled at me and said, "Why can't you be like all the other kids and go out and do drugs? Then you'd be normal." You know, so you just have situations like this that to say it's so bizarre. But again, you know, after the fact, you know, we can look back on it and it, like, you know, there's some humor in it, but it was really sort of an antagonistic, you know, kind of situation. But then there were these episodes that were just the complete opposite. When I had I was pretty directionless in high school. Because they hadn't gone to college. I didn't really know anybody who had gone to college, and I'm done with high school, so I guess that's what I'm supposed to do. And you know, I wound up, I could tell you, I told this story in Michigan. It was just that the place in Michigan, and I'll tell it here. This will give you an idea of how utterly clueless I was in high school. Again, I have no direction at all. I'm smart. I mean, I have a good short-term memory. I got good grades, but I have no idea what I'm doing. So I went in to take my SATs, and at the end of the SAT, they make you put a number in to have the score sent somewhere. Well, it's like, nobody told me that. I don't know what to put here. Like, what number do I put in here? You know, so they won't take the exam until I stick a number in there, and I have no idea what to do. So I get this big list, you know, all these numbers on, and I'm going through there. Okay, like, you know, I guess I could put anyone in there, but I ought to just look at it, you know, and maybe something will ding a bell here. So I put in the number for the University of Kentucky. You say, why, Mike? Why did you put the University of Kentucky number into your SAT score? Because I went to high school with Sam Bowie, who wound up going to the MBA, and Sam had just gone to Kentucky. And my thought, it was no deeper than this, was, well, if I go there, I'll know somebody. That was my plan. That was again the level of cluelessness that I was. So, you know, I took the SAT, but later on, I went to my pastor and said, "Hey, I'm going to be out of high school soon. What should I do?" And he's like, "Well, you know, you like the Bible and you're pretty smart. I know your grades are good. Why don't you go to Bible college? Why don't you just try that?" I said, "Oh, okay, I'll do that." Well, my parents, you know, got wind of this and were absolutely opposed. And so basically we had a confrontation where I said, "Look, I'm 18. I could sign up for the Army. You know, I could do a whole host of other things. And basically I have the right to do that. You know, I'm technically looked on as an adult. And if it means that I'm going to have to leave home and not come back to go to Bible college, I'll do that." And that you know, softened a little bit. You know, they told me not to apply anyway. But then my dad turns around and says, "Well, I heard you're taking this trip out to this college, you know, and you know we've got two or three cars, and it's just, you know, they're all junkers. And why don't you take our mobile home?" And I'm like, "What? Like, what did you eat? Are you the same person that you've been for years?" You know, I couldn't believe it. So we actually had this sort of luxury trip out there, but told me not to apply, but I actually did. And I still wonder to this day if I did the right thing. You know, I basically applied in secret, you know, got in, and then I wound up going there. And again, it was just part of this confrontation. And it didn't end there. And when I was, I spent a few years at Bible college, and my grandma lived with us at the time, and she was sort of my mole in the house. She was a believer. And she called me one day and said, "I think you should probably not come home for Christmas break." And I said, like, "Well, you know, what's going on? You know, what happened?" And she said, well, I overheard your mom and dad say that when you came home, they were going to take your car so that you couldn't go back. So I had to find a place to stay. You know, I was in Minnesota, you know, just sort of at the last minute because I couldn't go home. You know, so there were just things like this that happened all, you know, through my high school and college years. But again, trying to be obedient to my parents because I wanted to be consistent. And I didn't want to have anything I did affirm some sort of crazy idea they had or whatever. And so it wasn't the best situation. It wasn't, you know, awful, but it, you know, there could be confrontations there too. Now they're believers now, and I'm actually going out on the 19th, March 19th. I will be at their church in Delaware doing an Unseen Realm event that they have spearheaded. I mean, so now it's like completely opposite. I can have people disparage me for all sorts of things, but I basically can do no wrong in front of my parents. You know, it's just, they're my biggest defenders. They're just, you know, they're in my corner. They get it. Again, they're believers now. So it's just literally night and day. But, you know, we had all sorts of interesting episodes at home when I was in high school. But again, if you've read The Facade and the Portent, this is part of Brian Scott's sort of situation and the way he approaches things. Just do the right thing. Just try to do the right thing. And yeah, it's going to hurt. Ouch. But just try to do the right thing and let it play out. You know, let God do something with it, whatever he's going to do with it. That's what he'll do with it. Just try to do the right thing. And that was the way I had to approach, you know, my whole high school experience, you know, because I had become a Christian.
Awesome. Well, good deal, Mike. All right. Well, we're going to get back into some Bible questions. And
sure.
The next one is from Neil. What was the purpose of the pseudepigrapha? How do we know that these writings were not like the Book of Mormon to Orthodox Christians today? Why were they written in a style mimicking that of an actual historic event? How did the people of that time view these writings?
Yeah, the question, again, I'm going to quibble with the wording of the question a little bit. I mean, what we think of as the pseudepigrapha, when we use that term, the pseudepigrapha, you know, we're referring to this collection of books that we, you know, and I say we collectively, the modern world, you know, modern scholars over the last few centuries, we have collected these things and put them in a group, and we've called that group the pseudepigrapha. So because that's the case, there was no intent or purpose behind the creation of these books that would sort of, you know, all the authors of these books didn't have the same purpose. They didn't have the same idea. You can't look at it that way. Now, when modern scholars group these books together and call them collectively the pseudepigrapha, they are called that because they have one fundamental characteristic, and that is they were not written by the person's name either in the title or, you know, by the person who, you know, a sort of distant historical figure that they're about, but they may or may not, you know, claim to have been written by. So pseudepigrapha it doesn't mean false writings in that, oh, these are icky, don't read this stuff because it's all garbage in here. You know, it's all, you know, false teaching. It doesn't mean that at all. It refers to the authorship. So it refers to false attribution, like writing under a pseudonym or a nom de plume or something like that. That's the characteristic they have in common. So the part of the question about, aren't these just like, a Book of Mormon or something like that? You know, I think in some cases the comparison can be made, again, because we don't have... I should back up. I mean, the reasons why a pseudepigraphical book might have been written, again, most of the time the authors won't tell you, or you're not going to have a real good idea, at least a certain idea. The reasons they could have been written are so varied that, you know, when I give you some of these, you know, you could probably look at the Book of Mormon and say, oh, they're number four, that's where the Book of Mormon sort of aligns, or number three or number two, whatever. Again, so that's why I say you could look at the Book of Mormon this way, because, you know, do we really believe, you know, the story of how this book came to originate? Because, you know, the circumstances are modern, modern history. So there is a bit of an overlap there. But anyway, pseudepigraphy or pseudonymity, again, writing under a pseudonym. Again, we're talking about people who wrote things, and the content may be historical. I mean, if something that's in the Book of Enoch or 3rd or 4th Maccabees or the Ascension of Isaiah, they can write about a historical event. The event might be completely historical, well-known even. So, again, the content doesn't mean that the contents are not historical, that there is no, we'll use your favorite word now, Trey, historicity. There could still be a lot of historicity to it. So that, again, isn't really the issue here. It's just the claim of authorship that is false or that is contrived or made up. So you could ask the question, well, why did they do that? They might have good motives. They might have bad motives. Who knows? Some books get attributed to certain writers by historical accident. In other words, the book doesn't really claim it, but there's some church historical tradition that might have started in the second century that said this book was written by this guy, and then that just sort of sticks. And so then it gets grouped as a pseudepigraphical work because this is the authorship that's claimed for it, and there's no real evidence for it. But, internally, it doesn't even say anything like that. So you could wind up being a pseudepigraphical work for that reason too. But the writers themselves might have good reasons. They might have bad reasons. I'll give you some examples. D.A. Carson actually has a reasonable list of this. This isn't going to be his whole list, but again, these are sort of some of the common ones. But if you wanted to get a full list, I'd suggest reading Carson's article in the Dictionary of New Testament Background. But here are some possibilities. Sometimes writers did this out of pure malice. I'm going to write a book. I'm going to stick this name on it, and I'm just going to basically, make it all up. And I'm doing this to hoodwink the audience that would be interested in this. So you could have instances where it's malicious like that. They could do it because they figure, hey, people will want to read this. It has a famous name on it, famous biblical figure on it. People will read it, and I might be able to make some money off of it. I might be able to make my living like this. Again, that's not the best motive, but they could do it, for that reason. Sometimes they had something to say. Let's just say this is sort of a more academic feel to it, but they might have something to say, and they figure, hey, I'm a nobody. Nobody's going to read my book unless I put this famous name on it. And if it has that name on, then people will read it. So at least my ideas will get out into the public discourse this way. So that's a little more, of an honorable motive. If you want to use, it's more honorable than the other ones anyway. So they might do it for that reason, again, just to get read. Sometimes they would use an ancient name, stick it on the title of their book to get credence, for an idea, or to get people to interact with an idea that they had. Again, so that's part of being read. Sometimes you'd have a situation where maybe an author wouldn't put their name on a book because they're too modest to. So it's kind of the reverse of the other circumstance. Well, I don't want to, I don't want the attention here that this might get, for a good reason. I don't really need the adulation here or whatever they perceive might come of this on the positive side. So I'm going to put somebody else's name on it. So they could do it for that reason. Again, there are any number of reasons, why this would be done. Now, going back to the Book of Mormon thing, I mean, it's easy for us to look at that and say, well, Joseph Smith made the whole story up, because he wanted not only to be read, but also he wanted to gain or grow a following. Again, so since that is one of the possible motivations, for pseudepigraphical work, well, sure, Yeah, I mean, if that's how we're going to assess the Book of Mormon, again, I don't assign any inspiration to the Book of Mormon, then maybe that's what's floating around in Joseph Smith's head. Certainly possible in my mind. So yeah, there could be a connection to that, and it might be sort of the same thing. It's not quite the same, but again, kind of in the same category. But again, I think pseudepigrapha, they get a bad reputation because of the modern name that gets stuck on the collection, and again because of the idea of pseudonymity. But it was so common. I mean, there aren't like 5 or 10 of these things. There are dozens and dozens, maybe even into the three figures, maybe into the hundreds of these kinds of books that have survived from antiquity. So people knew this was a common practice. They didn't have the same sensibilities to it that we do now, because it was so common. And so, it's out of the gate, it's not right to sort of denigrate books in this category as though they're not important. Hey, a book like First Enoch was real important. I'm working on a book right now that really focuses on the importance of not just the Book of Enoch, but specifically within the Book of Enoch, the story of the Watchers, the importance of that story for New Testament theology. It's very evident Peter and Jude read the book, and it helped them articulate and inform, you know, their theology in a certain places and the way they wrote what they did write that became part of the New Testament. And they're certainly not the only ones, again, as the book I'm working on will demonstrate, and as I've discussed already in certain podcasts, there's a lot of that material that bleeds into the New Testament. So you can't just say because it's pseudepigrapha, it's not important. It doesn't need to be inspired to be important. And I think that's one of the disconnects that we have going on in our heads about the whole collection.
Okay, the next one's from Alan. How do we account for the vast amount of demons present? The traditional view can have as many spirits as it wants. Just say a third fell and you can make up a number. But if demons all trace back to the event in the days of Jared, how can we literally account for all of them? Or can we? How do 200 immediately sent to Tartarus watchers, a local flood and some conquest in Levant, create the amount that are present today?
Well, I would ask, first of all, how many are present today? And I'm asking that deliberately because we are never given a number. So again, here we are. We are back to a common assumption. There are myriads and myriads and myriads and hundreds of thousands and millions of demons out there. Really? On what basis would we draw that conclusion? Not of the New Testament. There is nothing in the Bible that gives us a specific number of demons or that even tells us it's a whole lot. There's simply nothing like that. The language that you get about myriads upon myriads, in Hebrew, this thousands upon thousands, and this kind of language, like in the scene at Deuteronomy 33, for instance, and there's one in Psalm 68. That language is always used of the good guys. That's always used of the host of heaven. You never see that language attributed to those spirits in rebellion. You just don't. So I'm going to answer the question that way. I don't know that it's vast. And since I don't know that the number is vast, I don't really feel any urgency to come up with an answer that assumes vastness for demons. There could very well be only a relative handful. You know, I don't know. We're not only not given a specific number, they're never described in multitudes in the Bible.
Okay, our next one's from Brad, and this question's about the Fern and Audrey episode, number 68. The question is about the involvement of demons and watchers in the various contexts that they mentioned in which trauma-based programming takes place, Satanism, sex trafficking, and government experimentation. Mm-hmm. Are watchers and demons involved in all of these kinds of trauma programming, or just the satanic?
Yeah, I can't. You know, speak precisely here for Fern and Audrey or how they would answer this, but, and they're the ones that really need to field a question like that, but I'll give you my best guess, having talked to them a number of times. My best guess is that the true demonic/watcher presence or involvement is pretty rare. Again, when I've talked to them, and this came out a little bit on the podcast too, that yeah, we do encounter that, but not that often. The problem is that, you know, people can be programmed to believe what's going on or that this kind of thing is going on when it isn't. In other words, Fern and Audrey, you know, would again be the first to say, look, a person who's been traumatized, whether it's in some sort of ritual context or something else, can be told that, oh, there are these demonic entities that are doing this to you or that are going to affect your life, that are going to do this, that, and the other thing to you. And that's just messaging. In other words, there's no ontological reality to it in that case. It's just a manipulative tool. So even when people, again, have such stories, again, I think they would say that they can't assume that that's actually what's going on. And to be honest with you, again, based on conversations I've had with them, they almost don't care because, again, their approach to helping people recover from trauma and the different messaging that goes with it, whether there's a non-human entity behind it or not, their messaging to the victim, to the survivor, is going to be the same. you need to stop believing lies. And that's where they, that's what they really focus on, to get people to not believe the lies that they have been told, again, by their victimizer, or that they've been programmed to think in certain situations, or that, again, they're this coping mechanism that they have and that we all have, this dissociation, that you know, lies become part of the way they dissociate from the trauma, again, as a coping mechanism. If a bunch of, you know, lies, theological lies or lies about you as a person are part of that, you need to stop believing lies. So it really doesn't matter to them what the origin point of the lies are on one level. But again, being careful, because I can't, you know, speak with any sort of, you know, professional competence here like they can, but they're going to say they run into it. But from the conversations I've had with them, they don't make assumptions about such things. And you sort of know it when you see it. You know it when it manifests, but it's not normative. In other words, to be, I don't know, this might bother some people, but they don't have a Frank Peretti view of reality here. You know, it's not that there's a demon lurking behind every rock or under every rock, behind every tree. There's not a demon that is at the root of all your behaviors, of all the things that you believe, the lies that you believe. In most cases, it's not. It's programming, and it's really the origin of the programming and the system of programming, the method of programming that varies and can include this element. But again, really, the way you get tracked back from that, the way you get healed from that, no matter what the, you know, the point of origin, the approach is going to be the same. I mean, if there are entities, you know, involved, then they're going to run into some other difficulties and whatnot. But I think that's probably the best I can do with this question, you know, not being on the same, not being at anywhere near the level of expertise that they have. But all of that is based upon conversations I've had with them and where we've sort of talked about the same question.
Well, Mike, since we're on the Fern and Audrey topic, now mm-hmm. would be a good time maybe to talk about the GoFundMe campaign, get an update on it. I just checked and it's over $2,000 now. So that's awesome.
Yeah. 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 For those that didn't see it on the blog, I would invite you to, you know, go up to my website, find the entry. I guess it's a couple weeks old at this point. Yeah. We're trying to raise money. Again, we're taking a long-term look at this, something that, hey, can we raise a certain amount of money over the next 2 or 3 years, to be able to fund people, cover their expenses that are involved in having a week of Fern and Audrey's time. And in the case of some people, it might be more than one visit a year. It might, you know, be one every year. I mean, it's hard to tell. And they, you know, they operate on a situation by situation basis, but they've operated this way for 11 years. They have no website. They have no Facebook site, you know, no page like that.
Intentionally.
And so a lot of the, you know, it costs money for people to get on a plane and go see them. It costs money to, you know, for them to have housing. I mean, Fern and Audrey have a location that they use for this, a house, but that costs money, you know, to maintain that, to pay, of course, the mortgage. You know, they don't live there themselves. They use it just for this, but all of this costs money. And of course, Fern and Audrey don't have other jobs. This is what they do full time. So there's a cost involved in that. And often, you know, survivors, you know, cannot pay all of that. And so a lot of the time they have friends or family that donate, you know, the money. I mean, I've actually donated, you know, once to get somebody out there. So, you know, we figured, hey, you know, the GoFundMe thing was such a pleasant surprise for the bibliography. Why not try this? And so we set an amount. The amount was 50,000. And again, that's over the course of, we're thinking like 2-3 years out. So it's not, you know, all 1 year. We think maybe 2 or 3 years we could get this and sort of keep it going over the course of 2 or 3 years. And maybe it doesn't get used up. Maybe half the people that need their time can pay themselves already. That's great. Then you save it for somebody else. But to sort of give them a little headway so that they can, you know, respond to the people, especially the ones who responded to the episode, to the podcast episode. They've had over a dozen people contact either you or me, and then we put them in touch with Fern and Audrey. And I always leave it up to them. You know, do you want to have a conversation with this person or not? And Fern has told me that they have over a dozen people that need and want a week of their time But basically all of those people, you know, have said that we really can't, you know, afford to do this ourselves. And so that's kind of what immediately prompted, well, we ought to do something about this. We ought to try to think long term, because as the show stays online, we all expect that it's going to grow. We're going to get more emails. They're going to get more contacts. More people are going to hear that episode and think, that's me. That's my story. Obviously I'm not going to give any names or any details, but during my Unseen Realm events, I have had someone come forward. It's happened twice. People come forward and saying, I know what this is. This is my story. This is my wife's story. This is my husband's story. We understand what this is and what the problem is and what the trauma is. Can you put us in touch with Fern and Audrey? And so I have done that, but we have people contacting us by email too. So people just come out of the woodwork. They hear it, and we all just sort of figure it's not going to stop. We're going to get a certain number of these every month, every quarter. They're going to get contacted. We're going to get contacted, you know, and we have to get contacted because we don't put their contact information up there.
Yeah, you can shoot me an email at treystrickland@gmail.com. And I'm excited that we have a direct infrastructure through McLot to be able to help people in need like this that otherwise have no way of getting funding. And Fern and Audrey don't have the infrastructure that now we have with McLot, and it's tax deductibles. And I couldn't be more thrilled to be able to be in a position to help these people that probably would not be able to have access to help at all.
Yeah.
And it's exciting that so many people are responding already. And I know Fern has already started preparations for a person. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. I mean, just an immediate impact for this. And it's exciting for McLot and for us as a community and the show and everything to do really good work like this. And, it's awesome.
Yeah, it is what it's for, because they are, like we said, intentionally off the radar, and that's just the way it needs to be. That's the way it functions, you know, for what they do.
I want to thank everybody who's donated and everybody in the future who will donate. It's an awesome cause to help these mm-hmm. people, and so thank you. All right, Mike. Well, our last question is going to be from Tammy, and it's regarding Luke 7:36-50. In lieu of your commentary on women's hair coverings, when the woman dried wiped Jesus' feet with her hair mingled with her tears and the perfume, is there any significance to her using her hair?
Yeah, I don't believe so. I mean, we're never told, again, she was seeking anything. And culturally, washing the feet was something a household servant would do. I mean, it was a job for someone of low estate, which, you know, when Jesus does it, you know, later in the Gospels, you know, Peter's pretty hesitant, you know, to let him do it. Again, it's a familiar episode. So the act of foot washing itself is a gesture of low estate and humility. So I think that is actually the point of the narrative. We're never told anything otherwise. But, you know, when you look at 1 Corinthians 11, Paul is addressing Gentiles in the passage, and the material that we talked about in that particular episode with the covering is all Greco-Roman. It's all Gentile, if we want to use that term, material, medical texts. So while I don't doubt at all that certain Jews would have heard about these medical ideas, I think Paul, of course, certainly was, because he was pretty well educated. So I think it's likely that Jews, again, knew that this is the way that Greek and Roman, Greco-Roman doctors, you know, look at hair and associate it with fecundity and all that stuff. Most Jews, the average Jew, like the Mary and Martha situation, you know, people just sort of getting along in life. They chances are may not have ever heard of it, and it wasn't really part of their lives. So I think, again, against the wider context like that, that it's something that if you were, again, if you had access to Greco-Roman learning, Greco-Roman medical text or something like that, or someone who did, and this was, again, something that you had talked about, okay, there's a chance that could have filtered into the average, you know, Jewish community. Again, there's a chance of that. But I think really it's going to take somebody like Paul, again, who just had wide exposure to that kind of literature, to really grasp it. And so I don't see it really being in view in an exclusively, well, let's just be honest, rural, kind of poor, you know, Jewish situation like we see in the Gospels. And again, there's nothing actually in that account that really kind of draws our attention, you know, to this sort of thing going on with the hair. The scandal of it is really the expense. I mean, when you actually get the scandal commented on in the passage, it's really about, you know, the cost of what she had used, you know, with the alabaster and all that sort of thing. So I think that's more in view than anything, you know, that would have been scandalous for some, you know, sexual reason or something like that.
All right, Mike. Well, that's it. Q&A in the can. So you want to tell us a little bit about your trip in Michigan?
Yeah. The trip in Michigan went really well. And I do want to give a kind of a shout out and a plug to our host, Landmark Community Church in Hazel Park, Michigan. The people there were just wonderful. And it's not, I mean, I haven't done this in the past, you know, with respect to other churches. And we've had nothing but the same kind of reception. I mean, just all good. The people, you know, that come to these things are sincere. They're eager for content. All that was the same in Hazel Park. But I wanted to mention them specifically because this is a church, you know, without getting into the details, that, you know, has really suffered in the recent past in terms of kind of committing itself, you know, to being serious, to having good content. And it's really, you know, led to a situation where, you know, I don't know how to put it any other way, but a lot of people have left, you know, who would be, I guess, less tolerant, you know, of content, sort of want other things in church. So if you're looking for a church home in that part of the world, that part of Michigan, Hazel Park, Michigan, it's a suburb of Detroit, you should check them out. I think you'll find some like-minded people there for sure, who are really appreciative of the content. So I wanted to make sure I said something on their behalf.
And you've got another trip coming up to Delaware.
Yeah, in Delaware, where my parents are. Again, that is, the actual event is the 19th of March, which is a Saturday. It's from 1 to 5. If people want the details, they can go up to the website, drmsh.com, with a slash in the events, or they can pull it off the drop down on the front page there under About. You'll see speaking schedule. So that'll give you the details there. The event is actually in Lewes, Delaware, L-E-W-E-S. But it's kind of weird. There's Lewes, Delaware, that's the address. But then the actual location is in a place called Angola. It's like, can't they make up their mind, you know, what to call this place? But it's the right, you know, it's kind of overlapping. So if people want to check that out, don't get confused by what you see on the events page. But it's near Rehoboth Beach. That gives people a better idea. So that's on the 19th from 1 to 5 on that Saturday.
Mike, I crunched some numbers and I found that if every one of our listeners donated $5 or more, we would make our goal. So wow. I really want to, we're doing great. And I want to thank everybody that's donated so far. And we have the listeners. And if everybody stepped up and donated $5 or more, we would reach our goal for full-time content.
Wow.
That's amazing to be so close. So
it is to have sort of the numbers actually be realistic. You know,
it's within reach. So that's amazing. And we're only hopefully going to grow the listenership. And with that comes more donations. But the fact that, you know, we have what we need now, and if everybody pitched in, boom, our goal would be met with McLott.
So yeah, if everybody gave and I could be unleashed, you would see a lot more production than that. Just trust me. I mean, there are a lot of things I want to do, but I am determined to do what I can with the time that I have. And it might look like success, but it doesn't look like anything that it could look like, again, if we were just sort of turned loose. But you know, we'll see what the Lord has. But that's really encouraging that the number of, you know, real people who are dedicated, you know, to downloading the podcast and, you know, visiting the podcast site and the site just generally, that the numbers are actually there. It's realistic.
Yeah, absolutely. And with the new website, I think we'll have more language about McLott, and maybe we'll see an uptick there.
Yeah. But,
so lots of exciting things happening for this year, and we're on track. And so that's awesome. I couldn't be more thrilled.
Yeah.
All of it. Well,
yeah, it's good to be moving in that direction.
Absolutely. All right, Mike. Well, what's the topic for next week?
Next week, we're going to talk about a phrase in Ezekiel that I get asked about a lot, the stones of fire. What are they?
All right, Mike. Well, we thank you for answering our questions, and I thank y'all for sending in your questions. And with that, thank you for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.